And welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington on this live broadcast from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Tuesday, May 2nd, 2023. Sudan's military leaders agree to observe 7 days of ceasefire effective Thursday.
The government of the Republic of South Sudan welcomes the 7-day extension of the ceasefire, the cessation of hostilities commencing on 4th of May to 11th May 2023.
And the UN says thousands of Sudanese are fleeing their country to the neighboring countries.
So over 100,000 refugees are estimated to be among those who have now crossed to neighboring countries, including Sudanese refugees, South Sudanese returning, and other nationalities who were themselves refugees in Sudan.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan announced that Sudan's warring military factions agreed Tuesday in principle to a 7-day ceasefire from Thursday as more strikes and shooting in Khartoum disrupted the shortest truce. A statement released by South Sudan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs says President Salva Kiir stressed the need for the importance of a longer ceasefire and naming of envoys to the talks, which both sides had agreed. Ambassador Paulina Dong is the spokesperson of the South Sudan's Foreign Ministry. She spoke with my colleague Nabil Biagio from Juba this past hour.
The government of the Republic of South Sudan welcomes the 7-day extension of the ceasefire, the cessation of hostilities commencing on 4th of May to 11th May 2023 by His Excellency General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the chairperson of Sovereign Council and Commander-in-Chief of Sudan Armed Forces, and General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, Hameti, leader of the Rapid Support Force, as a good gesture towards the escalation of the situation in Sudan that will allow for humanitarian access, safety for Sudanese civilians, evacuation of foreign nationals, and restocking of medical and food supplies. His Excellency President Salva Kiir Mayardit advised that this extension should be taken as the opportunity for serious engagement of the parties and to lay framework for the preliminary face-to-face talks by the parties as at an agreed venue.
Let me just interject here quickly. I'm looking at the sites of these warring parties, especially the RSF. And a few hours ago, they're talking about fighting and downing a plane. And South Sudan is announcing that there is going to be a 7-day ceasefire. Can you give me the backdrop to this ceasefire that the South Sudanese government, Salva Kiir Mayardit, has secured with the two leaders?
We are hoping that with this ceasefire that has been agreed by two principals, we are hoping both of them will be able to honor and the issues of bombardment, including the airport. We are hoping that this will be able to hold, and they will allow in access to movement, access to humanitarian and other things that are necessary for the citizens of Sudan and other nationals that may want to leave the country.
Yeah, what is the next step for President Salva Kiir if the two leaders have agreed to respect a 7-day ceasefire?
Now, the plan is that they will be able to nominate a representative to come and talk face-to-face. The only thing that has not been agreed at the moment is where will these representatives sit and do the talking. Previously, President Kiir has proposed Juba or any other place, any other country of their choice within the region. The most important thing here is for the party to sit and talk, because we believe, as a country, President Kiir believes, the only way to end this ongoing conflict is by talking and agreeing to resolve the issue.
These two generals, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, they have agreed to several ceasefires in the past 2 weeks. And the ceasefires have been violated repeatedly. What makes this one different, this one that you are telling us President Kiir has got them to agree?
There's too much pressure from the region, and there's too much pressure from all, including the Gulf and UK, America as well. A call for ceasefire, a call for a solution to this conflict. So we believe this has an impact on them. And also I believe that they're also beginning to see the magnitude of the damage that is causing. Many people are flaring out, the issue of humanitarian, you know, lack of food. People are looking for safety. The hospital, as we all know, has been bombed. So there are few hospitals that are currently working in Khartoum. So I believe that the two principals might probably also have felt that this thing is going to be a huge destruction for them as
yes.
citizens, as the people of Sudan. So we are hoping this time they will be able to commit themselves to what they have agreed upon, the 7 day. And we hope it, even from there onwards there will be some sort of agreement and so that this conflict is resolved.
I hear you. President Salva Kiir has been nominated to lead a three-member delegation. That was a decision by IGAD to mediate in this conflict in Sudan. What leverage does he have over the two leaders, General Burhan and General Hemeti, that would make him an effective mediator?
One of the very obvious reasons is our experience as South Sudanese. We have gone through more or less the same what Sudanese are facing today. And it was through this talk that we managed to resolve, and we were able to get this nation where we are in. So President Kiir found a better chance because he has military background, political background, and he understands exactly the situation on ground. So, and that's why the previous peace talk that took place in Juba was successful. Until then, that's when we had start to have this issue that has just happened on day 15.
That's Ambassador Pauline Adong, the spokesperson of South Sudan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. She spoke with my colleague Nabil Biagio from Juba this past hour. A Sudan expert says any ceasefire in the country must guarantee a mechanism to monitor the Sudanese army and the rapid support forces. Suleiman Baldo, the director of Sudan Transparency and Policy Tracker, says the combatants must allow delivery of desperately needed humanitarian supplies. This comes after news reports late Monday said the warring parties have agreed to send their representatives to another country, potentially Saudi Arabia, for negotiations. The reports say the talks could focus on stable and reliable ceasefire to be monitored by national and international observers. Suleiman Baldo tells viewers James Batty that it welcomes the news, given that both sides have repeatedly violated previous ceasefire.
Well, this is an interesting development, let's say, and let's keep hopeful that this time it will work. The two parties have already declared ceasefire 6 times, but have observed none of the ceasefires in a complete way. You know, there were always violations and fighting. This time, I hope that the fact that they are meeting face-to-face in Saudi Arabia, which has a lot of leverage on both parties, they would be more inclined to abide by their commitment to observe a ceasefire. My second observation is that a ceasefire needs to have a proper mechanism for monitoring and identification of violations and some form of pressures on the parties so that they stick to their commitments and not just make media statements that they are observing ceasefires. So let's hope it will work this time.
I'm sure now after the ceasefire there comes a more deeper discussion in terms of the future of the country. Where do you think they should be looking now?
I believe first thing, it should come first. We need first for the fighting to stop. And to stop, seriously, not with running battles between the two parties in Khartoum and across Sudan, in Darfur and elsewhere. And this is not yet the case. We need to ensure that there is a ceasefire that holds, a ceasefire mechanism for monitoring and separation of forces. And once we have the assurances that the parties are serious enough about ending the actual combat, they should also be required to grant humanitarian access for desperately needed humanitarian supplies, safe corridors for humanitarian workers and for engineers who want to fix the water stations that have been bombed, depriving millions, in Khartoum, the last capital, from healthy supply of water, municipal water. Also fixing electric grid so that people can get some electricity. Improving the health response, which is on the verge of collapse as we speak. All of these are things that cannot wait for any further delay. It would mean that people will be dying in Sudan as we speak. And once, we have a ceasefire and humanitarian response that is tangible and massive by the size of the disaster itself, I believe that talks should start on the political dispensation in the post-conflict. And that's a very delicate phase that people should prepare for. But it must be made clear to these two generals that there are consequences for their joint violations of international humanitarian law.
Before I let you go, Suleiman, the former Prime Minister Hamdok said over the weekend that he thinks there should be a defined role for the military. They should not engage in politics.
Well, this was where Sudan was heading with the political process that this war has prevented from finalizing, which is the exit of the military from the political life. I believe that the supporters of the former regime in Geneva, they did this to prevent the political process from concluding and to pave the way for the return to power.
That's Suleiman Baldo, the director of Sudan Transparency and Policy Tracker. He spoke with VOA's James Batty earlier today. The United Nations officials today say they are rushing to get aid to civilians caught in Sudan's brutal war, now in its third week, and say the conflict is creating massive humanitarian crisis. Despite the announced expansion of ceasefire on Sunday, there are reports of gunfire and explosions across the capital, Khartoum, today. The battle pits Sudan's army under General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan against the paramilitary rapid support forces led by General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. They had controlled a military-led government for 2 years, but failed out last month in talks to create a civilian-led administration. In Geneva today, the spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Olga Sarado, said several agencies are preparing for a massive flow of refugees.
Over 100,000 refugees are estimated to be among those who have now crossed to neighboring countries, including Sudanese refugees, South Sudanese returning, and other nationalities who were themselves refugees in Sudan. Alongside governments and partners, UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, has determined an initial planning figure of more than 800,000 refugees and returnees that may flee Sudan to neighboring countries.
Many Sudanese have fled into Chad, Egypt, South Sudan. Thousands have managed to join foreign nationals on evacuation ships or flights. Paul Dillon is the spokesperson for International Organization for Migration.
At least 334,000 people have been internally displaced within Sudan as a result of the fighting since the 15th of April. According to IOM's Displacement Tracking Matrix Network report, which was released last night and has been disseminated to media here in Geneva. The number of displaced people through the last 2 weeks exceeds, as a result of conflict, exceeds.
Tari Yasarevich, the World Health Organization spokesperson, say the World Health is rushing to get medical aid to Sudan.
We have 6 containers of supplies for the treatment of injuries and the treatment of severe acute malnutrition that were dispatched by sea and are currently being moved to warehouses in Port Sudan. We have another 30 metric tons of emergency supplies to be flown from our logistic hub in Dubai as soon as this becomes possible.
Yes, Sarevich also said the WHO has assessed the potential harm to a medical laboratory that has been occupied by fighters of the conflict.
We did a risk assessment of the situation, and the risk has been seen as moderate. And this is because the lab cannot provide its main function, and that's to provide the analysis and the diagnostics because of the lack of fuel and lack of trained staff. What we should really keep in mind that really the biggest health risk for Sudanese people right now is the conflict itself, where health workers and patients cannot access health facilities. Those health facilities are not available. So really the lack of access to health services, this is the main risk.
The aid agencies warn they are already facing funding shortfall, which has been worsened this year by extreme drought in much of Eastern Africa, as well as the conflict in Ukraine. Still on Sudan, the International Organization for Migration, or IOM, says it is preparing to use river barges to transport South Sudanese from the Sudan-South Sudan border sites in Upper Nile State to their original areas. Peter Van Der Auweret, the IOM representative in South Sudan, says the UN agency is providing assistance to the most vulnerable who are unable to afford transportation for themselves. He said those who are acting, he said his office is also acting, is partnering with other aid agencies to support 2,000 South Sudanese who have arrived in the country. Dengai Deng has more from Bor.
Peter Goch Anyang, a resident of Jonglei State, says citizens are prohibited from discussing certain topics, adding that the government agents interfere, control media companies, or intimidate individual journalists. Goch says newspapers, online news outlets, and the electronic media should operate without interferences.
Journalists are not free to inform the public about development in the country, as they don't have access to information. For sure, the government need to do what is possible to make sure that freedom of press is allowed in South Sudan by giving journalists access to information such that they can be equally shared with the public. Freedom of press is paramount to citizens because it allows people to express their views and make their views heard by the state government. So press is a voice to the voiceless.
Susan Gitao is the chief editor of the Juba-based Classic FM. She says one of her reporters was assaulted by a bodyguard of a high-profile leader while on assignment. Gitao says many journalists across South Sudan have experienced a similar ordeal.
Press freedom is still limited in South Sudan. Intimidation, threats, censorship, these are major challenges of press freedom in the country. The ability of journalists to report freely on matters of public interest remains a challenge. In my view, I believe that there are people who still do not understand the role of media because maybe they think journalists are...
We apologize for playing that wrong tape. We'll bring the IOM story right after the bridge. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, what is the state of press freedom in Africa? Find out why after the break.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's World Press Freedom Day tomorrow, and rights groups say scores of African journalists continue to be jailed, even killed, in pursuit of the truth. They say media freedom continues to decline across the continent, with the Horn of Africa and central and northern regions of particular concern. Embassies of the United States and UK in Juba are renewing their calls for an investigation into the killing of U.S. journalist Christopher Allen, who was killed during clashes between Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition and the government forces in South Sudan. South Sudan's acting Minister for Foreign Affairs says his government is investigating the killing of Allen. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
In August 2017, Lam Paul Gabriel, a military spokesperson for the former rebels of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, told the Center for the Protection of Journalists that Christopher Allen had embedded with the military forces of the SPLMIO for 2 weeks at the time of his death. Dr. Peter Ajak Bullen, the commander of the Medical Corps, SPLA General Hospital, Juba, told the UN-sponsored Radio Miraya on August 29, 2017, that an autopsy revealed that Christopher died from a gunshot wound to his head. The United States and United Kingdom embassies in South Sudan released a joint statement on Tuesday calling on South Sudan's transitional government of national unity to investigate the killing of U.S. journalist Christopher Allen. In a recorded statement provided to this program by the U.S. Embassy in Juba, U.S. Ambassador Michael J. Idala had this to say.
On World Press Freedom Day, the U.S. and U.K. embassies in Juba renew their calls for the transitional government of South Sudan to conduct a credible investigation into the death of Christopher Allen and to make the results public.
26-year-old Christopher Allen, a British-American freelance journalist, was shot dead in Kaya, South Sudan, near the country's borders with Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2017. South Sudan's acting foreign minister, Deng Dao Ding, says the transitional government of national unity is investigating what's transpired before Christopher Allen was killed.
We have taken note of the concern. The ambassador, a number of times, have come to us, and he said that his government wanted to get exactly what happened with Chris Allen. You may recall Chris Allen's circumstances of death were circumstances of war. When forces attacked the government forces in Kaya, and unfortunately his life was lost in that circumstances. So this is a matter that required time for government to be able to get into it in terms of investigation.
Dao says South Sudan's Ministry of Justice will continue to track events leading to Allen's death.
The government will continue to make effort so that the investigation can be done towards the circumstances that led to the death of journalist Christopher Allen. This is a government matter. We cannot talk about it now. We have received the complaint from the British and from the Americans. And all these documents have been forwarded to the Ministry of Justice, because the Ministry of Justice is the only arms of the government that can advise the government of what next of course of action to be done.
When Allen's body was brought to Juba's military hospital on August 29, 2017, South Sudan's Minister of Information and government spokesman Michael McQuay told reporters that Allen was, quote, a white rebel killed in the clashes. McQuay later changed the narrative and said Allen was killed in what he called crossfire as government troops fought to repulse the rebels. On Wednesday, May 3rd, South Sudan will join the rest of the world in marking the World Press Freedom Day. This year's theme for the 30th anniversary of the press freedom will be shaping a future of rights, freedom of expression, as a driver for all other human rights. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Juba.
Still on World Press Freedom Day, This year marks the 30th anniversary of the World Press Freedom Day, a day set aside to celebrate the importance of freedom of the press and freedom of expression. Some print journalists and managers in South Sudan say they face several challenges. One editor of a Juba-based newspaper says the cost of publishing could force some media houses to stay out of business. For VOA News, Juliana Shiapai has more from Juba.
In 2011, South Sudan gained its independence from Sudan. The country had a vibrant print media with dozens of newspapers and magazines on the streets of the capital, Juba. Today, the number of newspapers in circulation has shrunk to about five. Majority of the newspapers and magazines in kiosk over the years hardly lasted for 12 months before they closed. The president of the Union of Journalists in South Sudan, Patrick Oyet, says print journalists working in the print media are struggling to survive due to several factors.
There are no companies, established, serious companies that want to advertise in the newspapers. You only have a few institutions, maybe like, you know, Bank of South Sudan, National Revenue Authority, that will give advertisement to the papers. And all over the world, newspapers don't succeed because of selling the papers. Newspapers succeed because of selling space, that is advertisement. And now you are in a country where there are very few businesses that are ready to advertise in the newspapers. So that is challenge number one.
Oyet says poor infrastructure and lack of investors are some of the challenges threatening the future of print media in South Sudan. He added that the poor investment opportunities in the print media forces some newspaper owners and journalists to seek donor funds for survival. Matiang Serilo is the editor-in-chief of Al Mawqif Arabic newspaper. He says the cost of doing business in South Sudan is too high.
The cost of printing is still facing us. There is no any national printing press in the country. Okay, when I talk about the national press company, I mean those companies who print the newspaper. So we don't have any kind of this. And we, from time to time, we have to increase the price of the paper. And this also affects our readership.
Serilo says lack of conducive political space in the country makes it difficult for print journalists to balance stories. The editor-in-chief of South Sudan's oldest English newspaper, the Juba Monitor, was arrested last year for allegedly defying a court order to stop publication over the alleged malpractices. Anna Mariano was arrested in April 2022 after not acting on an order issued by Juba's Kator High Court to shut down the paper. Print media owners in South Sudan continue to tackle high expectations from journalists who demand for decent compensations. Matthias Samuel Timatio, a print journalist in South Sudan, says he barely makes money compared to his counterparts in the broadcast media.
You write for a media house at the cost of 1,500. With the current situation, how can this help, you know, somebody who works every day to make sure that you get a story for a media house? And then also you find it's not easy to operate in this country, and there are a lot of challenges, you know, when we talk about media, print media houses in the Republic of South Sudan.
In 2020, the Association for Media Development in South Sudan conducted a survey. The result found out that the highest paid print media journalist in South Sudan makes about 40,000 South Sudanese pound a month, which is the equivalent of $49 based on the current exchange rate in the parallel market. The survey also found that the lowest paid journalist in South Sudan makes about 10,000 South Sudanese pound a month. The theme for this year's World Press Freedom Day is shaping a future of rights, freedom of expression, as a driver for all other human rights. The Union of Journalists in South Sudan says this year's World Press Freedom Day will be commemorated in three states, capital of Wau, Yambio, and Juba. For VOA News, I am Juliana Shiapai in Juba.
That's all we prepared for you this Tuesday. We now leave you with General Paulino and the song Shekel Manga. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. Don't forget to visit voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this broadcast, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. On behalf of our producer Kwame Ofori and engineer Kayla, we wish you a good evening and remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.